in Yorkshire. And my background is in classics, with a particular interest in Greek poetry. And the condition of poetry in pre-classical and classical Greece is something that underpins what I want to talk about. My title, A Relevant City, the Symbolic Resources of Art and Poetry, relevant in that is a direct homage to a remark made by Richard Rogers, the architect, when he gave a presentation of his Lloyds Bank project in 1980 at the Royal Institute of British Architects here in London. During the course of that presentation, so this is 1980, I need to say this, that's 3 years after the Pompidou opened, and 4 years after Charles Jenks put the term postmodern out into the world. So I think it was a question from the audience, with about 500 people there, that's really packed. And someone asked Richard Rogers about postmodernism. If you remember what the Pompidou looked like when it opened, it was brand new and clean. I mean, it still looks incredible when you look at it from the top of these steps in Sacré-Cœur. It just looks like a new thing from planet Zog. So, obviously, someone was going to ask him about postmodernism. And his remark, which I'll never forget, was, "I thought to be modern meant to be relevant, and I don't see how you can get post-relevant." So that was a wonderful remark to make. Of course, the purpose of this conference, what you're trying to do, is to find out, two things. Not just a relevant city. I was in Istanbul about 4 years ago for the second time in about 40 years. Istanbul is about 40 kilometres across, and no one knows how many people live there because people are constantly coming from Anatolia. And as a human built environment, I mean, it's completely mad, as I'm sure is Lagos and Cairo and other places. London's not far off either. But it's not just trying to find out something about the relevance of a city to respond to actual human needs. What I'm wondering about, and why I'm very much interested in what's going on in this conference, is a kind of problem of translation, which is how you translate the kinds of things that have been talked about here. For instance, that in-betweenness that you just talked about, which is something that Homi Bhabha talks about in Cultural Challenge, that we must hold back all our subjectivities and collective subjectivities, otherwise we'll start killing each other, as we usually have done. So a problem for me is, however, is not just translating or characterising some of these things about ephemeral and obscure things that are part of being human, but putting this into discourses that can be persuasive for the institutional players who actually build these environments. And I'm saying that partly because I worked for 4 years with planning officers, council officers in Bradford on regeneration projects, which went nowhere. And what they always would do is throw back in your face, "You don't understand." And of course, the absolutely wonderful phrase that they always seem to get away with, "Be realistic." At which point you have to, well, I have to, evoke, bring in any number of post-war French thinkers, Lacan, and his modelling of subjectivity between the symbolic, the imaginary, and the real, the capital R. And people have talked about the edges of discourse and how institutional powers elide, or hide, or conceal, or do everything possible to keep you away from the edges of discourse, because if you can get to the edges of discourse and see why they're there, not there, then the authority of the institutional power can dissipate and collapse, and they don't want that to happen. I want to put, in terms of the symbolic resources, the condition of art and poetry, I just want to put an image into your mind. In the 8th century, some of the Greek cities, possibly for reasons of overpopulation or protecting trade routes, sent out colonies to southern Italy, Marseille. And what they did was they actually sent out, say, four or five ships with families, and to lay out the city, when the ship got there, they sent with the ships a poet. And the poet was the topographer. The poet validated the layout of that colony, because the colonies were meant to be autonomous. They weren't meant to keep on going back to Corinth or Chalcis to get instructions as to how to carry on. They were supposed to be autonomous. And so the poet gives a validation and in fact an authority for the city to be like that with its functions, religious, political, market trading and so forth. So a poet lays out the city. And the authority of the poet doing that comes from the fact that the poet has a special relationship with the gods. The first line of Homer's Iliad shows you the imbrication of that authority. The first words are, Menin aede thea, sing to me, goddess of the wrath of Achilles. There's an imbrication. There's an imbrication of the authority inside the poem. There's a couple of things people want to just mention that you may not have, one in particular, this verse one, that you may not have come across. I've already mentioned it to one there, Delegate. A book which has helped me enormously thinking about the condition of art and poetry, which is a book published in 1948 by Ignaz Meyerson, which has never been translated, I don't know why, called Les Fonctions Psychologiques et les œuvres. Oeuvre here might be translated as cultural works, as they include language itself and religious practices as well as art. His work is very much about the active, transformative nature of cultural tools. Thus, in the case of the religion, there is an originary event connected to a remarkable personality, which is both singular but also invested in to become significant, exemplary, and indefinitely renewable. The regulation of our conduct, of our feelings, of our thoughts is centred on this possibility. The repetition, at once commemorative, symbolic and real, of the initial divine act. Somewhat more up to date, if you haven't come across it, this is for you to go and find out. There was an issue of the magazine Science et Avenir, I think in 2001, which was devoted to the cognitive unconscious. And there was a couple of very interesting essays in that, one by someone called Bernard Le Chevalier, who discusses a cognitive unconscious which performs a kind of pre-editing of probable expectation of the significance of an encounter with something in the world. Why I find these neuroscientists, the work that they're doing, interesting is because they're digitally mapping synaptic activity, which is obviously emotional as well as intellectual. And it may be within 20, 30 years, they may be able to find out to what extent cultural learning, understanding, episteme, is actually, to what extent it's culturally learned and to what extent it's common to human beings, which will be an amazing thing to find out. Right. What you're looking at, does anybody know what this place is? Wild guess. It's Todi in central Italy near Perugia. And I read one time ago, and I'm afraid I can't remember where, that Todi is the model kind of Greco-Roman European city because it's got 1.5 squares, which creates a to and fro and actually prevents a kind of totalising space as well. This is an aerial picture of Gatehouse and Fleet in Dumfriesshire in Scotland, which is one of the first industrial model cities. You might not be as familiar with this, somewhere like Saltaire near Bradford in Yorkshire, and it is an early one, it's last part of the 18th century. And you can see, I think, very well from this photograph that this grid system of workers' houses for the, I think it's a flax mill, is sort of jammed into this sort of membrane of the river. And here, it's almost like it's going to pierce it, like it's piercing the skin. I don't know how sympathetic you think it looks to the landscape, but it doesn't look very sympathetic to me. Although it feels, actually, compared with workers' houses in places like Bradford or Hull or Leeds, actually the space around them is quite generous. But nonetheless, it is sort of, for me it raises a question, why, if we're going to build a built environment as opposed to live in a wood or by a stream or by the seaside, how come is it we so often build something that isn't lovely? Right, I've got sort of three people to look at. Not just in terms of how they design buildings and environments, but also, certainly in the first case of Victoria Sotsas, how they do use language, not in a straightforward academic way. I actually saw Sotsas speak in London at the then Boiler House in the V&A in 1984 or something. And if you've never read his writing, it is truly inspirational. This is a drawing for his so-called grey furniture from about 1970. A huge bed with rounded corners and neon lights, a mirror with a wavy neon frame, a corner cupboard framed by round cornered fluorescent tubes, a table, a bookcase, a magazine rack, and so on. And this is what Sotsas himself said about the grey furniture. Grey is a very sad colour, maybe the colour my hairs are going into. I mean, a colour that will create some problems for anyone who would like to use it for advertising detergents, toothpaste, vermouth, aperitifs in general, Coca-Cola, electrodomestici, deodorants, and all that. And this is his very wonderful grey butter dish. This is from a suite of lithographs he did, again in the early 70s, called The Planet's Festival. And the description of them, of some of them, this is from a Museum of Modern Art, New York, exhibition catalogue called Visionary Architectural Drawings from 2002. The Planet's Festival drawings and lithographs depict such super instruments as a monolithic dispenser for incense, drugs and laughing gas set in a campground, rafts for listening to chamber music on a river, and a stadium to watch the stars. This is one of Sotsas's photographs from his very extensive travels. If you don't know that much about him, he's got a kind of, not schizophrenic, but perhaps more very interesting, talking about in between this, an interesting double inspiration, American kitsch consumerism and Eastern spirituality. Quite an amazing combination. This is a house in India that he photographed. And this is, I'll just read you a bit of some of his travel notes, which were published in a big Swiss journal called Terrazzo The first one came out in 1988. It ran for about 7 issues until they ran out of money. It cost them $50 to produce each one, and they were selling them for $30, so they gave up in the end. But it has been collected, Terrazzo, into a small format which reproduces all the various images in it and the texts. So this is a bit of this. I've actually printed this out. I've got photocopies over there. I've printed out a bigger one. I'm not going to read all of it. In all the places I've been to, I have felt someone there was designing houses. Just as in a wood, you can feel the presence of mushrooms. I think that architects sometimes don't design houses, but ideas that can be had of how to design a house. And then they design the ideas about how to design the ideas to be used to design a house. All this to say that there are times when architects, as specialists, as a special caste, collect ideas about architecture, a gigantic quantity of ideas and information about architecture, and then this information is organised, published and communicated, interpreted, supported, and then catalogued, until eventually all this information and all these catalogues become to core the actual existence of architecture itself. They become the manner itself, the manner of being understood. And he goes on to talk about play, and then his uncle Max, who had not stayed at Innsbruck to talk with the priests of the big churches to get commissions for Baroque altars to be carved in wood. He hadn't stayed with his carpenter brother to talk to the rich owners of hotels, restaurants, trattoria, so that they would give him commissions for wooden doors, facings and furniture. He had simply gone off across the open sea, who knows, maybe eastwards, to Bangkok, Canton, Yokohama, or maybe even further, this is not known. Evidently, my uncle Max did not think of solving the problem. He didn't even believe in a solution. My uncle Max did not even agree to play the game of those who are protected by others, who are protected by others, who are protected by others, ad infinitum. Just two more practitioners I wanted to put before you. This is the work of a Slovenian architect called I'm not going to be able to pronounce this very well, Marjetica Potrec. Does that ring a bell, anybody? Right, well, there's a very good article about her in Frieze magazine in May 2006. These are two other buildings. This one here, this bit of this one here, is made out of milk crates. And this is a little extract by Jennifer Higgy with some quotes by the architect herself. When asked about why she shifted her career from architecture to art, she said, "I don't like the idea of sitting in an architect's office and drawing plans, poring over papers and thinking about a city as a body that you can control, save and operate like surgeons do." In many ways, her artistic lineage can be traced directly back to the fascination Dada and Situationist artists and writers had with the aesthetics of everyday life, with the idea of the city as an organic moral entity, and to their shared belief in social change being integral to creativity and vice versa. Then this is a quote from her again. "One could say that the empowerment of individuals through architecture is political, and this is true. Design and aesthetics, after all, have never been neutral, but this misses the main point. For it is simply a question of human dignity to be able to build your home the way you envision it." I haven't brought it here, but she, if you have a look at her work, have a really good look at her dry toilet. You've never seen anything as exciting as her dry toilet. It's very good. Oh yeah, just two. I mean, someone who embraced, if the situation in big metropolitan cities is leave it a mess, someone who definitely embraced leave it a mess in his work in the early 80s is the architect Nigel Coates. And this is one of his restaurants in some big Japanese city. If you can see, it's got this sort of mid-century Boeing aesthetic, and inside it's got neoclassical statues. It's got, are there any architecture? What's the name of that a painted thing in the middle of the ceiling? It's got a name in architecture, hasn't it? Okay, anyway, there's one of those that looks like a Baroque painting right in the middle of the ceiling. So it's just like a lot of things slammed together. I call it sort of genre collision. And there are cultural reasons why he could do this in Tokyo, whatever city it is. We know that after the war, of course, American stuff went all the way over to Japan. But I found out that, in fact, Colombia already had a trading agreement with Japan in 1927, shortly followed by RCA. So they were putting, I don't know, swing records or something into this very traditional Japanese culture even before the war. And finally, this is a projection by the New York Polish artist Krzysztof Wodyczko, and this is, I think, is one of his most powerful ones. It's the monument, is the monument to the Civil War dead. I don't know which city it's in. And the projection is of a homeless person. So for me, that's making the point, well, yeah, we had a civil war, and that was then. Well, there's a civil war going on right now between the stinking rich and the poor. It's a great piece of work. And I'll just read you, it's very brief, something he said in Foreign Art, which is published in the Hybrid State Exit Art, New York, 1992. The artist who wants to make a contribution to this present, a world displaced, seen as a house where the past and the future live together, would need to learn to function as a nomad sophist in a migrant polis city, in a migrant city providing new language tools. As a practitioner of democracy in this place called public, which is politically guaranteed but effectively non-existent because empty, the new sophist, like his counterpart in ancient Greece, must recreate an agora, public square, or forum every time he or she wishes to speak or listen. The sophist must be prepared to play a questioning role which goes beyond corrupted forms of communication. In a democracy, the most important right is that of representation.